Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Ralph. Today we are joined with a special guest host, author Joseph Bedell of Shell Game, Evil Deeds, Terror Cell, among many more. Joseph, how you doing?
Great, John. Great to be with you.
And today's show, 2 hours long. First off, we're going to have author Jamie Mason, followed by Juliana Baggett, Linda Rocker, and Jake Patterson. And all the 2 hours of Suspense Radio will begin right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Joseph, again, thanks so much for joining us today as special guest host. We've had you on before as a guest, but now it's great to have you on the other side of the microphone. And again, everybody, it's also Joseph Bedell, Shell Game, Terror Cell, Evil Deeds, among a lot more. JosephBedellBooks.com. You can go find out a lot more about him. But right now, we're also going to jump into our first guest, author of the book Three Graves Full. Author Jamie Mason, jamie-mason.com. She had to put the hyphen in there. That's too much. That's a shame. But Jamie, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I have to say that is the most wonderful intro music. For some reason, I've been stuck on hold 25 times in the last week with the most heinous music bleeding into my ear, and that was fantastic. I love that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, we try to make everything for our guests and for our listeners just a wonderful, suspenseful radio experience.
Well, I wouldn't be anywhere else. Suspense radio, I mean, I'm home, right?
So there you go. So now, you know, and Three Graves Full, you know, Simon & Schuster was so gracious and, you know, they actually sponsored a couple shows with your book, and now it's great to be able to talk to you about it. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about the book Three Graves Full that's maybe not on the back cover, that would give them a little bit more, you know, insight into it.
Well, one of the things, I had been asked to do a really short, almost a Twitter-style pitch, and I thought about the core of it, and I thought, imagine you're a poor homeowner, and somebody has discovered a body in your flower bed, a skeleton, and the horror and terror you feel, but mostly because that's not the body you planted in the backyard a year and a half ago. So, yeah, we do have a guy who is not a bad guy. He's not a bad guy, but he has killed someone and buried him in the backyard. And Jason has a tendency to do the wrong thing. And once he has done the wrong thing, in fine non-psychopathic form, he can't do any yard work anymore. So when he hires someone just to make the front look pretty, they make a terrible discovery of a body there that is not the one Jason put there. So he has about 300 pages of problems after that.
Well, that sounds to me, I mean, just that's enough to get me to want to crack the book and read it. And now I got to tell you, Jamie, before I ask you about the book, even before I read your work, I was hooked. Anyone that likes Formula One racing, football, and drinks whiskey is my kind of lady. But I think one of the things that many authors don't seem to get is that a lot of readers will put down a book if it doesn't grab them by the throat in the first paragraph, or at least by the end of page one. In Three Grays Full, you not only grab the reader by the throat, you punch them in the heart. And, and you know, that first sentence, there is very little peace for a man with a body buried in his backyard. You got to read on. And how long did it take you to get that first line down? I mean, did it just come to you, or you know, what process did you go through to come up with that opening line?
I have been so excited and surprised that the first line sort of has taken on a little life of its own. You never know how it's going to be received. I remember being very thrilled with the first line, but it really, every time I write, my inner schizophrenic just wakes up, and the first line has a tendency to come into my ear out of the ether, and I don't know how that happens, and I love it. That's always when I know that I'm allowed to keep going, when I get this special thing. So I loved the opening. The whole way it came into being was kind of because I was working on something entirely different, and I was very frustrated with a story that I was working on, because I'd gotten some great stuff, and I'd gotten to a point where I was stuck. And I work with a guy in the UK. You don't know him, but someday he's going to be on this show. His name is Graham Cameron, absolutely a fantastic writer. And Graham and I always swap work, and he said, okay, forget it. You're tearing your hair out. Just let it go. And he said, go to the newspapers and pull headlines. He said, just, you know, go online or to newspapers, you know, in your town, and just look at headlines, write a few down. Do not read the article. Now, I do wish I had saved the link, because I never did read the article that sparked it, but the headline was Landscapers Find Skull in Mulch Bed. And I was supposed to write a story that would result in that headline. And so that's how it started. And then the first line came to me when I was brushing my teeth, which, you know, after I was trying to think of it. So it was really exciting, and I felt like I had been sanctioned by the writing gods to go ahead and give it a whirl.
Yeah, and one of the questions that I ask a lot of authors lately is, because I think it's very crucial in suspense thriller writing, is the beginning of the book or the end of the book, which do you feel has the biggest impact on the reader, but which is more difficult to write as the author?
For me, now, you ask 10 writers, they'll give you probably 10 different answers, but for me...
And they do. And
yeah.
They do. So I'm trying to put them all together in a concise thing to say this is the way it's going to be.
I would like to see the statistics at the end, because for me, the dismount is the hardest. It's just like in gymnastics or anything else. You get started and you have the excitement and the momentum. And to end with a confident thump, to make it satisfying, to make it right, you know, you don't have some crazy thing happen at the end that doesn't make any sense, and to close that back cover wanting more but not to the point where you're going, what the hell was that? That's the hardest for me. And when I read a book and I close that back cover and I'm like, yeah, that's exactly right. I know that Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl is a bit controversial. For me, it couldn't have ended any other way. Close that back cover, and I said, if it had been anything else, I don't think it would have worked. And it was great. And so I do think the endings are terrifying for me, because you got to nail the dismount, or you definitely get your 2/10 deduction from the judges.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
I absolutely agree with that. I think it's, you know, you're so full of passion and excitement when you start the book, and the problem is that passion can continue to the point that you never want it to end.
Right.
And that truly is a problem. I get that question all the time about how do you know when the book is done? Well, you know, it's just done.
Right.
But I, you know, Jamie, I wanted to ask you. There is a thread of humor that runs through your book. At times it's wry, at other times it's kind of sick, but I mean, there's this strain of humor that runs throughout the book. Where does that come from? What do you ascribe your sense of humor to?
Well, you, in writing this story, and I do hope that, that this is something that I can keep going in different stories, a lot of times it felt, while I was writing it, that same feeling if you bang your knee or you fall down the last three steps and bust your butt, and it's awful, but it's so daggone funny. And you sit there in a pitiful fit of laughing and crying. And I remember when things would go wrong for Jason and how wrong they go, it was funny, especially because it wasn't happening to me. It was very much the wordy equivalent of banging your elbow. And why is that funny? Why some sort of acknowledgement to how desperately wrong, everything's fine and everything can go so desperately wrong so quickly. And I really felt like a physical thing, that pain giggle. And so I think that I'm so glad it came out because I did laugh quite a bit while I was writing it just because, like I said, it wasn't me and I didn't have these problems. So I don't know. I think it's I get in a little bit of a rush. I'm not much of a daredevil in person. So that's where I get my rush is finding the funny wherever it hides.
I think humor is one of the hardest things to put in a book, and it's you really did a good job.
Thank you.
You accomplished it, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely, because you almost, it's very difficult. You always know that there's a couple tangents that go along with suspense and thriller. A lot of times it's romance. Very, very few times is it comedy, because you're in such, a thrill ride pacing back and forth with killer or whatever the controversy may be, it's very difficult to find that comedy. So when you can, I think it's a refreshing for a reader, because I think that they expect more of the romantic kind of thing, but then you throw something twist at them, it gives them that little extra, like, this author's something different than the norm.
That's really interesting that you say that, because while you were talking, it reminded me, I get teased a lot. I don't do very – now, I love stand-up comedy. I don't do very well with comedy films. It is a very rare comedy film that I can enjoy, but I love my comedy in my horror. I love comedy in drama. I love comedy in suspense, because I think it feels real. Because life, even when we all laugh. If one more bad thing happens to me, I'm going to laugh until I cry. We actually do this. We don't live a comedy movie. You don't have everything is hilarious for, 2 weeks that's represented in a movie or a book. And so I have a hard time. I the suspense of disbelief, I almost have more trouble suspending disbelief for constant funny than I do for monsters or, ghosts in the hallway. So that's very funny. I guess that's why it worked out, because that's where I find my funny is in especially in films and entertainment, is when it's in another, that it's riding sidecar to something else.
Yeah, good point. I think particularly this is your debut novel, and I think for those people that are listening in that are in the process of writing or have finished their first book, and it might be helpful for them to hear the process that you've gone through, how long you've been at this, and then kind of a quick synopsis of the publishing process.
Sure.
Do you have an agent and blah,
yeah,
blah, so forth?
Well, the way it worked for me, and I've found that this number keeps coming up. It's a thing. And it was almost 10 years. I did write my first novel. I think I'd love to dig that out at some point. It is a ghost story, and I think it has training wheel marks all over it. But I could never get anywhere with it. And then I was very afraid that, oh, well, maybe I could only ever do this once. And so, Three Graves Full, it doesn't take me this long to write a book. I wrote chapter one, Halloween 2006, but I was also still, my head was very much invested in my other story, and it took a long time to get there. And then I did go the route of looking for an agent. And I will tell you, by the end of that, finding it's very nerve-wracking. You spend a lot of time at your email hitting the refresh button. You say, how about now? Okay, how about now? How about now? I would have to make deals with myself. Okay, go. You're going to make the bed and put in the laundry, and then you can check again. Okay, how about now?
Yeah.
Bye. And it'll make you a crazy person. But once you do get that matchup, to have a person who is in the business become passionate about what you've done and to get it the way you get it. It's so incredible. You're not alone anymore. And I know that there's a wave of self-publishing it and not going with that route, and that's fine. There's a lot of avenues for that, and it's great. I will say that as a first-timer, I we can't put this on the air, but I'd probably pay my agent double.
Yeah.
So to have that partnership and somebody who has all the experience in the business and knows what to do with it and knows who might be interested, when I got together with my agent, Amy, it wasn't, you know, then she knew what to do. And then the rejections, the first few editorial rejections came, and it wasn't just me, you know, it wasn't just me. So that was helpful. And then you get the yes, and it's just as great as you remember. It was funny, we just moved, and when we left, the last thing I did in my old house was go stand in the spot where I got the call that I knew that we had gotten an offer from Simon & Schuster, because it's a huge dream come true. And so that was, you know, my process. I did write the book and write it and rewrite it a little bit more and write it one more time, and then go on the agent hunt. And I had been given advice, go with the passion. If you have a reputable agent that is excited, that's where you go. And it really has been a wonderful partnership. And then she sent it to editors, and then we hooked up with Karen Kostelnik at Gallery Books. And, you know, I'm supposed to say they're professional and experienced, and all of that is absolutely true. Every single person I've worked with at Gallery Books is delightful before they're any other thing. I mean, it's just been a blast. They're fantastic. I can't say, I have nothing bad to say. It was an absolutely wonderful experience, and I hope I get to play in the sandbox again.
Well, I think for those that are listening, excuse me, John, I think for those that are listening in, hear what Jamie said, and that is that she's been at this 10 years, and
yes,
she first wrote the first part of Three Graves Full in 2006, which is, you know, 7 years ago. So this is not a first of all, it's not a get rich quick scheme.
No.
And it is hard work. So congratulations, Jamie.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here, too, with author Jamie Mason, and it's jamie-mason.com. And what I always like to say is, especially for debut authors, your real-life suspense novel is that time when you write the end and you send it off, and now you have to wait for the responses to come back. And that's you living your own real-life suspense novel. Like you just said, you're hitting refresh, and you're getting rejection after rejection. Then you finally hit it, and you're like, oh, my God, and then the relief finally hits. But now you realize that you're just at the beginning.
I know.
And now your journey really starts.
This is true. Now, there's a funny story about that. I'm going to tell a story on my agent because, you know, you've been all through this.
Good.
Trying to get the agent, right? And you're freaking out, and you become an absolute maniac with your email. Okay, how about now? And then you get the agent. And then it starts all over again. And with that, and how about now? And, you know, we had been sending it out to some editors, and I remember I was getting my children ready for school, and I checked my email for probably the third time at that point because it was only 6 in the morning, and I get an email from Amy. And you know how you can see on your email, you have who it's from, and you have a title, subject, and then you
Right.
see the first few words of the email. So I see that it's from my agent. Now, the book used to be called The Liar's Margin. That was the original title. And it said, R.E. Jamie Mason's The Liar's Margin. And then the first words of her message are, finally, finally, some good. And I almost barfed in my own lap. I was so excited. I tried to grab the mouse. It skittered away from me. I drug it back. I clicked on it. So help me God, the next word was weather. Finally, finally, some good weather. So I screenshotted it, and I sent it to her, and I said, thanks, I'm having scotch for breakfast. I appreciate that. That was great.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Yeah. I mean, you're so excited thinking that something, and you're like, good weather, are you kidding me? Don't email me that no more.
Was it about then?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, if she ever has good news for me now, she goes, hey, you want to talk about the weather?
I was going to say, that I could see you injecting a chapter in the middle of the book about how your protagonist kills an agent.
Yeah.
That's brutal.
It's just self-defense, and that is just self-defense, right.
So let's get a little bit about maybe, you know, the characters or the character that you have kind of in the book is Jason, you know, Jason Getty. When you started going with Three Grace Bull, you know, it's always like the, you know, the chicken or the egg. You know, was it the character that kind of decided that you were going to write the book, or did you kind of have the plot and then you kind of had to work things around it and your characters around it? How kind of was the, you know, the whole conception and the building of getting it finally done, you know, when you first started?
Sure. The way that worked was that, you know, when I realized landscapers find skull and mulch bed, and the very beginning of the plot came to me was that there was a guy who buried a body, and then another body, eventually two other bodies are discovered on the property that he didn't do. So then I thought, who would be the most interesting kind of person to have this happen to? And Jason, you know, he's not a serial killer. He's not even, he's a non-aggressive almost completely. And I thought that that would be the most interesting, because I do think that even the most mild-mannered, we all have very rich internal lives. You know, even if nothing, you can't see anything on the outside, but every person has dreams and hopes and fantasies and sick parts of them and good parts of them and terrible parts of them, and you never see it. And so I thought that a mild-mannered guy would be, well, it also had the most opportunity for funny, too, because this poor guy is a fish out of water at this point. He's trying to negotiate this terrible crime that he would never, I mean, anybody who would know him would say, well, Jason would never hurt anyone. That's crazy. So that was pretty much a given, right, when I first thought it up, that it had to be a guy like Jason. And after that, then it just was a matter of that his frailties are something that most of us, anybody who's not very alpha, could probably identify with them, you know, not up all the way up to the murder part, but to the point where we've disappointed ourselves by not being as bold as we need to be or as firm as we need to be. And that's, it's just that for Jason, it goes very much more wrong than it does for most people.
What is next, Jamie? What are you working on your next book?
I am. I'm working on a novel that's kind of still a suspense novel with an element of spy thriller to it, and it's about a woman who her mother was a government agent, and they lived a suburban life, and mostly nobody knew there was anything weird about their lifestyle. But she had some resentments, and she did not care for the weirdness that was part of their lives. And her mother, by the time the story starts, has passed away, and she's grown up, and she realizes that she thinks her husband wants to have her killed. And so she starts drawing on the memory of her mother, what she knew about her mother, to try to find out if her suspicions are correct, and goes on from there.
When Simon & Schuster got Three Grace Bull, then how many books did they get you in the? You got three books. You got how many books did they get you for?
Well, they get first look at everything. Well, at least when I do. So we hope to have something to show them here soon. Like I said, I'm in transition, so I haven't been working quite as diligently not nearly as diligently as I should have been. But yeah, I'm really hoping they go for this one, because I would love to work with these guys again.
Okay. Go ahead, Joseph. I'm sorry.
No, I'm intrigued by the theme of the next book. Is any of that autobiographical?
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, it's very, very now, I'm from Washington, D.C., and so, you know, we have spooks all over the place. But
yeah, that's why I asked.
Yeah, no, and of course, nothing about the actual case, but Valerie Plame, a very, very famous suburban spy, and she just led a totally normal life. I mean, she took her kids to school and the play practice and all of those things. But she also had a very important government role, so very, very loosely inspired by her situation. But no, not autobiographical. My mother would laugh.
No, any series in the future? Do you have, you know, have you been thinking about anything like that? I know that that's like the big thing is people love to write series now, but it's I always find it refreshing for standalones also. So you got any of that going on?
I do not. I actually prefer standalones, but I have been asked, I've been very surprised, because to me, Three Grace Bull did not seem like the sort of thing that would have a chain, you know. But right. people have suggested to me a story about Harris, or a story, more stories about the two police detectives. It was not in the plan, but it's been asked enough that I would consider it, but it wouldn't be it would not be a strict series where you'd have recurring characters. I don't have anything in my head for that right now. I'm not against it. I know in my own reading, I usually prefer standalones. I don't know why, but I know it is very popular right now to have a series, so it wouldn't hurt my feelings to be popular.
Oh, I it wouldn't be. Well, hey, we're going to try to see how much popular we're going to make you by getting a whole bunch of new fans, because we want to thank you so much for coming on today. Author Jamie Mason with the book Three Graves Full. Jamie-Mason.com is her website. So, Jamie, I mean, time flew by, and we want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing not only the journey but the book and everything you got going on wrapped up around in your world right now.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on. I so much appreciate it.
Good luck, Jamie.
Yeah, and, you know, can you stay in contact? Let us know when the next one comes out, and we'll try to get you back on.
Absolutely. Gosh, yes. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, you have a good day, and we will talk with you later.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that was author Jamie Mason. Jamie-Mason.com is her website. The book is Three Graves Full, debut novel, another one that should be on the bookshelf. We are going to take a short break. We are going to be back here with our next guest, Juliana Baggett, and the second book in her Pure trilogy called Fuse. And in the meantime, we got a little something for you. Welcome, everybody, back here to our second segment here of Suspense Radio, two-hour-long show. We're 30 minutes down, and that was, of course, we just talked with author Jamie Mason there in her book, Three Graves Full. We're transitioning now over into our next guest, and her name is Juliana Baggett. And this is the second book in her Pure trilogy. The first book was called Pure. This one is called Fuse. It's julianabaggett.com, JulianaBaggott.com. I'm not going to spell it again, so if you want to, you can go back and listen to it and see what you do. But Juliana, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yes, and like I said, Fuse is the second book in your Pure trilogy. Like I told you off the air, I always felt that the second book in a trilogy was the most important. You can kind of look back in history because it's transitional, where you have The Empire Strikes Back, you have, you know, The Lord of the Rings and The Two Towers. It's that transitional book that takes the reader into a different plane that's going to finish it out in the next one, but you always got the twists and the turns that go on in this one after the first one. So tell us a little bit about Fuse, and for those who might not know the series and getting new, maybe kind of how Pure started and kind of how it transitions into this book.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think of a trilogy is kind of a three-act structure. And so, you know, that second book is the second act where the bulk of the action happens. So, yeah, I get your point there. Let's see. Well, Pure starts with a girl. It started out with a, you know, the image kind of in my head, being haunted by the image of a girl with a doll head fused to her fist. I didn't know why she had a doll head fused to her fist, and I at the same time I knew that I wanted to do something big and cinematic, and I eventually realized that this girl was kind of hiding away, trapped in a cabinet, and kind of being hunted down. And so eventually I realized that it was in a big post-apocalyptic world, and that you know, these detonations had occurred, and that everyone who had survived the detonations had survived fused to an object or a thing, whatever they'd been close to. So there was a girl; she was only 4 years old when it happened. She was holding a doll, so she was, her, you know, hand became a doll head. Then there's a guy who was riding a bike, and his brother was on the back of the bike, and he's fused forever to carry his brother on his back, fused to his back. There's a character who's running through a flock of birds, and he has birds embedded in his back. So we have this, you know, big post-apocalyptic world. The first book, you know, is a lot of world building and a lot of very strange, bizarre creatures who are beasts and dusts and eyes that blink up from the sand and all kinds of crazy creatures. And then there's also a dome where people survived, unfused, unmarked, and there's a boy who lives in the dome who always thought his mother had died in the detonations, but then realizes that there's a chance she's still alive. So he escapes the dome to go and find her. And so this Pure, this boy unfused and unmarked, and the girl with the doll head fist, their lives are kind of entwined and set on a collision course, and it becomes this thriller. So in the second book, I had a real, there were a lot of things I wanted to do. First of all, it was exciting because the world had been built. I got to create new creatures, but I didn't have to spend as much time on the page kind of trying to create a really believable post-apocalyptic setting. I'd done so much of that world building already. So I could really take off with the characters, those kind of villainous, brutal characters that I have, as well as the ones that are really trying to do the right thing and struggling. And I got to, one of the other things I noticed about trilogies sometimes or series is that you kind of start getting feeling like you're in the same place over and over again. Mm-hmm. And after page 1,000, you're like, can we get somewhere else? Can we move? And so I really wanted to take the characters far beyond just what I built. And so I really do have them travel, and we get to see new landscapes. And we also get to go deeper into the dome, which is, like, the outside world is big and brutal and violent, and a lot of your fears there are physical fears. And inside the dome, it's much more psychological and creepy, and all the fears in there are kind of this psychological torture. So I get to balance between different ways to torture my characters and the readers, you know what I mean, and to keep things pretty exciting. So I got to go in really deep in book two.
Juliana, I looked at your website, and you've got all of these graphics all over it, and I started to think maybe this is how Juliana's mind works, that you've got about 85 balloons up in the air at any one time. I mean, you've written, at last count, I think 18 books under three different names. Mm-hmm. What do you do in your spare time?
Well,
or do you have spare time, I guess?
I really
like,
don't
I guess
have
that's
spare
the
time.
That's the point.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about, we really did think a good bit about how to visually express all the different projects that I'm working on, have worked on, and so we just decided to make this website where my brain is in the middle, and then we just have all these offshoots, you know, all the essays, you know, I write essays for the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, and I, you know, have books of poems, I've been in Best American Poetry, I have kid books, I have adult books, I have all over the place. So, yeah, that was a really a sketch that I drew freehand and then handed off to a very kind of confused and baffled web designer, like, are you kidding me? Really? So it is kind of a lot going on at any given moment. And I have four kids, so the house is always, you know, big, loud, and noisy household that I'm, you know, trying to actually run away from. that's why I write books, is that, you know, it allows me to shut myself in a room for many hours at a time. So a lot going on.
Well, it's very impressive. Very
thank
impressive.
You.
Yeah, and the one thing, so I sit there and I read some reviews, and I always read and I always find it interesting because, you know, the New York Times Book Reviews mentions Mad Max, and I'm wondering how many readers remember Mad Max. Is that one of those things like, you know, because, of course, Mad Max was one of the, you know, one of the first Mel Gibson films when it made him popular, but it was so long ago, and I'm like, couldn't they have thought of something a little bit better? So that's why I kind of liked when they said The Hunger Games, because then people can relate. Do you kind of feel that way when, you know, when people are trying to, because, you know, when your books are so complex, you have so much stuff going on and so many things, do you think that, you know, when you get those kinds of things that people are misconstruing maybe what you're trying to write? Because sometimes that happens, and I feel that reviews can kind of mislead the reader, and I think that that's wrong.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, one of my early reviews was kind of a negative review in the Washington Post, but they actually described the book perfectly. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, their final opinion of it was blah blah blah, mixed, whatever. But they described the book so perfectly, and I ended up the next week on the Washington Post bestsellers list. So, and I really felt like I was just so thankful for that review because, I mean, whether she liked it or not, she got it, you know. And so sometimes that's even more important than, you know, the reviewer's opinion kind of at the end of the day. But, and I've worked as a reviewer too, not very much. I'm really not very good at it. But I have reviewed, and it is hard. I mean, it's very hard to try and kind of, in a very succinct way, try and, you know, explain where somebody stands in terms of literature, film, you know, or kind of pop culture context, you know, in a snapshot. You know, one of the reviews of Pure was that it makes The Hunger Games look like a garden party, which I thought that was lovely. But, yeah, it's funny, like Publishers Weekly called it horror, and I had no idea that it was really a horror novel. I mean, I knew that I was kind of doing something more in thriller and you know, there and obviously dystopian and post-apocalyptic, but I didn't really think of myself as horror at that point. But, you know, since then I've come to embrace that. I understand where they were coming from. So you kind of learn, too, where other people are approaching and how they're approaching the work. So, yeah, I mean, the one thing about the New York Times reviews is they said it wasn't a political book, which I think any time a writer is saying we as a culture are doomed and you have to spell out why we're doomed, you know, it's pretty much a political statement. And although it's a small part of the book and it's the backstory, I feel like I was pretty political. But, you know, that's okay, neither here nor there.
You know, you've come a long way since Girl Talk was published, and you've had commercial and critical success. And let's assume for a minute, which a correct assumption, that you're an excellent writer. We have a lot of listeners who are first-time, you know, published authors or writing that first novel. And what would you say for their benefit have been the elements that have contributed to your success? Again, starting with a basic foundation that you have to be a good writer.
Well, you know, I mean, over time, for one thing, I'm also a daily writer. And for me, becoming a good writer is being a daily writer for many, many years. I mean, you know, Malcolm Gladwell talks about 10,000 hours, and that research is based on Anders Ericsson's work of his 3 to 4 hours a day of guided practice for 10 years. So if you don't love what you're doing, or at least feel engaged by the struggle of what you're doing, you're not going to put in the hours. And, you know, I'm only good at what I do because I've done it and done it and done it and failed at it for a very, very long time and just kept coming back for more, and I still come back for more every day. So, I mean, that for me, it's the dailiness. And and also, you know, over time, I've learned to become much more creatively efficient, and I've learned a lot about my own process. I'm very aware of my own process. A lot of writers aren't. A lot of writers are like, oh, well, when the mood strikes and when it comes to me, and they become very mysterious and weird when they start talking about the process, and I'm very much more nuts and bolts about how I approach and, you know, how my process has changed over time. And, yes, I've had to be. I mean, I'm with four kids, and I'm the sole breadwinner. I have to be efficient.
Yeah, you can't. You know, it's not a hobby, is it?
Right. No, it's not a hobby. Certainly not.
Yeah, and the one thing that intrigues me too is when you write about a subject like a post-apocalyptic, something that no one's ever experienced, you know, because we've never done it, we've just always had to try to dream about it. Mm-hmm. What was kind of the pull? Was there a certain book, a certain movie, or something that made you sit there and want to think a little further to say, I want to take my spin on what I think post-apocalyptic will be like, or something to that effect? Was there a thought process of going on with that, or like, what was your pull to that kind of time frame for the books?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, in terms of detonations and atomic bombs, we have been through it as a culture. So I did look at oral histories of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and there was a book that's been taken off shelves for inaccuracies, not about the bombings, but about the U.S. soldiers involved in all different kinds of things, called Last Train from Hiroshima. And I used that book. You can still find it here and there, but anyway, and hopefully it will be reissued. But anyway, I used that book because it's really from people who survived. And so a lot of the things in the book that, you know, seem like they've come from my imagination are based on what really happens during, you know, during an atomic, after an atomic bomb hits. Including the shadow stains, you know, the people who disappear but their shadows are left imprinted on walls, and, you know, the fires that take over, and, like, you know, people, like, with lace collars that look like they're wearing lace collars because their skin has peeled from their neck, you know, all those things. In fact, the word fusings comes up, things being fused together. You know, tricycles and knitting needles being fused together after the atomic bombs were dropped. So I actually, you know, a lot of people are like, wow, it's a really brutal book. And I think, well, you know, what human beings have done to each other and what they continue to do to each other, it, you know, is pretty brutal. So,
You know, on a slightly or a lot different subject, I saw that you and your husband, David Scott, have co-founded an organization called Kids in Need, Books in Deed. And first of all, it's wonderful to see a writer give back to their art as well as to society. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this organization?
Yeah, well, we are housed right now at the FSU Florida State University Foundation. So they do all the accounting for us because, you know, thank God, you know, we can't do that. We don't have that ability.
You don't have enough time to do accounting, Julianne?
I don't. Mostly what we do is we get books. We play Robin Hood with books. You know, we go to a school that's well-funded or private or something like that, and they do book drives, and we move those books into Title I schools or into guardian ad litem programs for kids whose parents are going through the incarcerated or going through that process, the judicial system, you know, we worked for a while with Gadsden County, which is a very poor county in Florida, and worked through the health department, getting books through visits with social workers into people's homes. So we've had a lot of different programs there that we've done. One of the things we do, so we do a lot of book donations, moving books around, used books. And then with cash donations, like right now, this spring, Donna Gephardt is a novelist for kids, and she's going to do a reading down in Florida at a Title I school, and we go in and make sure that all the kids get a paperback copy of one of her books. So, you know, because most of the times, you know, an author comes in and people order the books. Well, not in a Title I school, not when 99% of the kids are on free and reduced lunch. So so those are the kinds of programs that we do. And we try to get other people, encourage other people to do it other places too, and we kind of say, this is what we do, this is how we build those bridges. So we'll talk to anybody in any state, you know, about how to get it started.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, that's and like Joseph said, I mean, it's always good to see authors that give back and do those types of things. And again, I just remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Juliana Baggett. Her book is Fuse. It's the second in her Pure trilogy, with Pure being the first one. So now when you're going and you're looking at the whole entire trilogy, because you already have it down and you're probably already done with book three, it's just in the editing processes or whatever.
Yep.
Do you when you finished it, did you feel, the trilogy is the way I wanted it to go, or are you kind of like, you know, maybe it's something, and Burn is, and just so people know, Burn is going to be the third and final book of the trilogy. Do you feel that is it all wrapped up? Are you gonna take things out? Do you know kind of in the future, is this going to be it for Pure, or do you think people are going to see little snippets of it in other of your works that are going to start coming out after the trilogy's done?
I think that I did the big bulk work of getting these characters to face their greatest fears. I mean, that is my, job, is to put so much pressure on them that and force them into, their greatest fears. What has been lingering and pushing and building throughout the trilogy. So I think I did that. And I do kill off one major character as well, which is always, not everyone can survive. I mean, it's not possible. So sorry. Not everyone survives. I do feel like in the broad strokes I did what I had to do. And then, let's see, there are certain characters I'm in love with, and I do already see myself doing little one-offs here and there. I imagine there'll be a couple little short stories, just of these little characters, I can't quite let it all go, is what I'm saying. I reserve the right. to continue to, work on these characters, so...
Yeah, just as long as you don't kill a dog.
Okay. Always save the cat.
I made that mistake one time, and I got booed by 500 people in an audience. That'll never happen.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yeah. I had somebody, write me that they'd put my book in a wood stove, burned it in a wood stove because of the animal cruelty in the book. And I went back to the book, and I'm like, where is the animal cruelty? What do they do? And there is, at one point, there's a dead bird that someone puts in a jar. But it's already dead. I mean, it died of natural causes. I mean, sure, it lived a nice long life. But anyway, that was too much. Too much. Too violent.
Yeah. And that's the person, that really is probably still upset over what happened in Fatal Attraction, even though it's something that needed to be there. Not everybody lives correctly. I mean, it just happens, and that's just life. And people, and that's what I always tell people, have to understand when they write certain things. It's like, oh, well, this person would have never, that's like a stupidest statement that I've heard anyone say in a book or whatever. Yeah. And I'm like, so you mean to tell me that when you're on the street, you don't hear people say stupid things every day?
Right.
That's just the way it is. Books are supposed to imitate life. So it's like, come on.
Yeah.
Well, on the hierarchy of the death scale, you can kill all the men you want.
Right.
Yeah, that's for damn sure.
You can kill a lesser number of women, but you can still kill a lot. You be careful about killing children, but never kill a dog and a cat.
Never kill a dog or cat.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. I'm going to keep that in mind.
Since Girl Talk came out, the industry has absolutely been revolutionized, and mm-hmm. now all of a sudden you've got, well, first of all, there's an awful lot of good work that never saw the light of day. Now there's an awful lot of bad work mm-hmm. that can easily get published through the internet and so forth. Where do you think we're going? Do you think we're going to come out to some kind of a balance at some point, or is this just going to continue to escalate where you've got twice, 10 times as much stuff being published as people can read, and there's no quality filter being put on the system like there used to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I love the democratization of the arts. That technology has allowed so many more people voices. I mean, just in film and music and visual arts and in writing. I mean, so that's really exciting to me. I love that so many people have so much more access. and just distribution. You know, I mean, that is, I see as a huge positive. And I think that there will always be gatekeepers and there will always be tastemakers. It's just the way the culture works. And so, you know, when I look for recommendations, I'm not trolling through Amazon blindly looking for my next book to read. I really know, you know, the friend that I trust. I really know the novelist that I love and, you know, book that they're recommending. And, I'm pretty savvy. You know what I mean? I don't
right.
just go looking hither and thither. And I also know publishing houses that, you know, who, like, I like this little quirky imprint or, you know, this kind of, you know, different things like that. I do trust certain imprints when I'm looking for a very specific thing. I also love editors. And so a lot of the talk has been very vitriolic to editors because they've been gatekeepers, you know, because they can only publish so many titles per year. You know, they're only allotted so much money. And so the vitriol against editors is upsetting to me because I owe them so much. I mean, my books, so many of my books would just have been just much lesser, you know, and they've made them more uniquely what they should be. And so that's the only time when I get a little bit like, yeah, let's calm down a little bit. Let's not be so vicious. These people do fantastic work, and they still are, some of them are dynamos on the page. Really, really incredible collaborative participants in the process.
And see, and I think that's the one thing that I'm going to piggyback off of Joseph is that your books go through that harsh editorial process, and they go through that rigid, you know, where you sit there and you're going to go, oh, my God, I have 550 things that they want me to look at in this book. Whereas what I call us, we're in the American Idol age where mommy says you're a great writer, but you're really not. They don't go through that, and they put it out there. And so while the technology has allowed a lot of authors to put out, it's also hurt authors like yourself that write such great stories and go through that process because people and consumers are only having so much money to spend, and therefore it's kind of taking away from that point. So I do agree that editors are a huge, huge help, and I think that more people when they write should know that, and they need to know that it needs to go through that process to make themselves better, like you've had to do, and the struggles that you've had to go through. And that's what makes you so successful and so entertaining, because you've been there. You've done it. You slept in the back of a van.
Well, thank you for bringing that up.
Well, okay. I don't know if you actually slept in the back of a van.
No, I had my first two kids well under the poverty level. So certainly early on, you know, we struggled. But I will say, though, it's not my career I'm worried about. What I'm worried about is the really, really talented young writer who's really, really good and still a little bit raw and very young. And what they really need is 5 more years to take that really great idea that they have and hone it, and then, you know, have the copy editor, the proofreader, the agent's house, the blah, 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 really work on it to give them the best shot at creating a really beautiful piece of literature. And instead, they're a little impatient, and they're a little bit too excited about that professionalization and jumping into professionalization too quick. And then we get this kind of raw thing that could have been so brilliant. I mean, could have been like really the next huge, monumental, smart thing if they'd been put through this, you know, questioning and asking and editing and, you know, reattack it. So that's the thing that I worry about more, that we're missing out on really what could have been really great literature because the younger people aren't quite willing to show self-restraint. They don't know to show self-restraint, you know, and they jump into publishing a little too early. So, you know, and then some of them do get picked up and then brought in, and then, you know, we get to see, you know, what they do next, which is great. But anyway, so that's more my concern.
We have about a minute left, so I'm going to give you the last word here. I'm going to sit there and say, for people who read Pure, or people that might not have read Pure, when they go ahead, and of course they should read, if they haven't read Pure yet, they should probably go back and read that, because since it's a trilogy, it's going to tie it in. So let's just talk to the people that have read it. When they pick up Fuse, let us know here, and, you know, like I said, like in about 30, 35, 40 seconds, What is the one thing that you're going to do to them that they're going to be at the end of Fuse and they're going to say, damn it, burn better come out tomorrow?
Well, those are the emails I get, like people begging me for sneak peeks on burn. I really allow them the time to spend with these characters and that I ratchet things up. You know what I mean? Everything gets more intense. So I hope that they enjoy the ride because I certainly, I think I deliver. I think that's a good ride. I hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, Juliana, we want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing a lot of insight on a lot of different subjects, especially your book, Fuse, which again is the second in the Pure Trilogy. JulianaBaggett.com is your website. Thank you so much for coming on. So when Burn comes out, which is probably what, in the next 4 months,
comes out in February. So you'll get paperback of Fuse, and then you'll get Burn. Yep.
So we'd love to have you back on so we can finish it up and we can wrap the whole thing together, and we will, you know, we'll talk with you then. So thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. I appreciate
it. All right,
have a good day.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that was author Juliana Baggett with her Pure Trilogy. The book is Fuse. Go back and read Pure, then read Fuse. The books are out now. You can find them wherever they're sold. And we are going to take another little break here. We're halfway through our show. We're going to be back on with author Linda Roker. And in the meantime, here you go. I want to thank everybody for staying with us again here today. We are halfway through our two-hour show of Suspense Radio here. We've had some fabulous authors that have been on. We want to thank Jamie Mason, and now we want to thank Juliana Baggett for being on the show. And now starting off and kicking off the second half of the show is author Linda Roker, which I said incorrectly the first time, but you all know that I'm not good at last names, so I'm so glad she told me and straightened me out. So author Linda Roker here, and it's lindaroker.com. The book is Punishment, and we want to thank Linda for coming out. So how are you doing today, Linda?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
We're doing fabulous. And again, Laura, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Punishment. It's a legal thriller. So what can you kind of tell everybody that might not be on the back cover of the book and give them a little bit more insight?
Well, I'd be delighted to tell them about the book. The book is really the result of the old adage that people should write about the things they know. And having been a lawyer and judge for 25 years, writing about what happens in a courthouse and what prosecutors do and don't do and what defense lawyers can and sometimes won't do is kind of meat and potatoes for me. It's an opportunity for me to bring people behind the bar and behind the bench and get a real feel for how political trials sometimes are, how predictable the outcomes are. For example, on the bench where I served in Ohio, we have 34 judges. And the day of the Simpson verdict, we all gathered in the chief judge's chambers to watch the verdict come in. And before it was announced, we took a straw vote as to how many people believed that Simpson would be acquitted. And 33 of the 34 believed he would. Among them.
Yeah.
And contrary to popular belief, it had nothing to do with race. It had everything to do with the way the case was indicted. What it's sort of garbage in, garbage out. You know, whatever the prosecutors present to the grand jury and what they ask for as a charge is going to determine the course of a trial. The same thing was true with the Casey Anthony case down here in Florida. I want my readers to not only have a rollicking good time with a lot of plot lines, some romance, a little bit of sex, a couple of murders, a lot of mayhem, a bombing, and plot threads that all mysteriously come together in the end, because that's what thrillers are about, as I'm sure you know. I have a ball writing these things. Everybody back in Ohio who reads the book calls me or tweets to say, oh, I know I was probably the prototype for this judge or that bailiff or that clerk. And in fact, they're partially right because I can't ignore my experiences. And so their character assets and defects pop up in characters I create. In many cases, I'm combining characters and imagining them. So it's a very fast read because I think people today, while I hope they will take time to read Hilary Mantel, 400 and 500 page books are sometimes saved for a long vacation. So I've made my chapters short. I make the pace very quick. I like to dangle hints as to what may come. There's a lot of O. Henry in my writing. And people who read the book just, they roar. They love it. They love it. And they love the fast pace and the thrill of some of the outcomes. So I've had just a great time writing it, and the second in the trilogy is just about done, and I can't wait to get it to the publisher and out on the shelves and internet. So that's where I'm coming from.
Linda, this is Joe Bedell, and I get asked all the time about where do I get my ideas, and my typical answer is you don't have to make this stuff up. And reading Punishment, my impression was that you hardly made anything up. I mean, basically it was all based, the book was based on a lot of personal experiences in your career as a lawyer and a judge.
Very, very many of them, although I'm restrained, as you might imagine, Joe, by the ethics of talking about cases that were not decided and were not conducted in public, and I'm very cautious about that. I did have a pit bull murder case in my courtroom that Court TV covered for 5 weeks. And I still, somebody will say every now and then, I saw you on Hard Copy. When did you cut your hair? And I say, oh, about 20 years ago. But the gentleman who was convicted in that case, as it turns out, I sentenced him to 15 years to life and had assumed that he might be out of jail by the time I published the book. Unfortunately, he is not. But every reference to the case that is not fanciful is based on public record. So, but you're absolutely right. I mean, so much of this is beyond what you see on Law and Order. Law and Order wouldn't dare be as bizarre as what actually happens in these courtrooms.
I mean, and that is so true. And the funny thing is that I'm originally from Ohio, grew up in Columbus, and the other funny thing is the first thing you mentioned was the O.J. Simpson case, and we've had the honor to be able to interview Marcia Clark a couple times because she's written some fiction thriller books, and so we've been able to, you know, get with her and, you know, have her in the magazine, have her on the radio show. And it is very refreshing to see that while, you know, you're a judge and you have all this experience, that when people pick up the book, Punishment, and again, you know, if you said it's the first year coming in the trilogy, is that they're going to know that there's the realism in the book instead of a doctor writing a legal book or a lawyer writing a medical thriller. They're going to get things wrong, but they know that when they read Punishment that this is kind of how it is. And there's that realism effect that they're going to be drawn into these books, and you have the pace so fast that that's what makes it so good. And that was very smart, you know, to write about what you know. And you have 100 books in you from your 25 years experience. How did you go ahead and kind of pick this kind of out as this is how you wanted to kind of bring out your debut and do your trilogy?
Well, that's a great question, and thank you for your kind comments. The reviewers seem to have felt the same about the realistic presentation of the legal questions. I'll tell you, as a judge, after I decided not to run for re-election, I started to work as a visiting judge, which means you get the overflow cases from people with an active docket. It may be the most boring thing I've ever done in my life because you don't get criminal cases. You get all the fender benders that the still active judges don't want to deal with. And it's the only case on your docket, which means that instead of having 10 pleas and a couple of probation violations to deal with during a recess, you're there and you better find things to do. So I began writing about interesting cases I'd had because I wanted to point out especially some of the flaws in our judicial system, why we have so many people in jail, why they are so overwhelmingly minority males, why the jury system is the only thing in our judicial system that absolutely works, that's almost foolproof. And I realized if I wanted people to get this, writing a treatise or a nonfiction book would be great because my family would probably buy it. There's no guarantee. But beyond that, I'd probably have to pay people to read it. And so I just looked at what I had done one day sitting in this gorgeous paneled chambers, and I said, this is silly. I could have so much more fun and get my point across, get people to understand how this system works, where the flaws are, where the strengths are, maybe even how they might have to deal with it, God forbid, someday, or a loved one, and have a good time doing it. Have it just osmotically get to them. I mean, if E.B. White had written a book about how we should be kind to spiders, I don't think it would have had the impact that Charlotte's Web did. Mm-hmm. So I took my cue from that.
You know, Linda, the legal system for the average American is really opaque. I mean, it's a very intimidating, complicated process. It seems to be unnecessarily long if you get caught up in the system. Yet, from Sheldon Siegel to Scott Turow to Parnell Hall to John Grisham and on and on and on, legal thrillers never seem to go out of favor. And whether it's on television with all, you know, with all these Law and Order shows and so forth, or it's in the written word, we as Americans seem to be fascinated with the legal process. What do you ascribe that to?
Well, I think it is because of the mystery that's inherent in it. It really is gladiators in the Colosseum. But
that's enough. That is a very interesting. I've never heard that before. That is fascinating.
And by the way, when I'm up on that bench, I'm the lion. Okay.
That I did not expect, John.
We want to see who's going to get one leg up on the other guy. Ever since Perry Mason, the surprise in a courtroom is unbeatable in fact or fiction. And I try to incorporate that, as I did with the prosecutor, and nobody gets caught off guard as often as a prosecutor. And that is because the average assistant prosecutor in a major court has hundreds of cases on his desk. And he or she is counting on 99% of them entering a plea of guilty to some lesser included offense. The really savvy criminals know that. And what they do is wait to the last minute and say, I'm not going to plead. I'm due to go to trial today, and I'm ready to go. You take me to trial, Mr. Prosecutor, and prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt. It is a winning tactic so often that it's downright frightening, because the prosecutor has not spent weeks preparing for trial. He doesn't have his case all laid out because he was counting on a plea bargain. And I've watched guys get off one after another because they knew how to play the prosecution. So there are all kinds of maneuverings and surprises in a courtroom, and I think that's what the public loves.
Well, you know, And I think you're the perfect person to ask this question, too, because how the hell do I get out of my speeding ticket that's coming up May 2nd that I just got? Because I don't know. Because, you know, I think that, you know, when you're talking about, you know, and I think legal thrillers got extremely popular, not just with Law and Order, but I think it was probably the O.J. Simpson case when it was in everybody's home and it was real. And then people wanted to see what was really going on, kind of the behind the scenes. And I think it's the unknown from that, because everybody thought he was, you know, guilty, and all of a sudden he was acquitted from it. So when you write the legal thrillers, it can go kind of either way, even Law and Order. Sometimes they get off and sometimes they don't. So that's the fascination. So when you're writing the book Punishment, you always have it in there, because when you're reading it, you're like, are they going to get him or are they not going to get him? Because it could go either way. And were you kind of consciously thinking, I'm going to take the reader in that direction to say, maybe they won't find him, maybe they will, maybe they won't. And that's kind of the bantering back and forth like a tennis match.
Exactly. Well, you touch on an important point, and that is the change in how the average person sees the system at work because of the introduction of television into the courtroom. It makes a huge difference, a tremendous difference. It isn't hard to use that to kind of toy with the reader. And I think giving the reader the human dimension of who the prosecutor is, who the judge is, what the bailiff is like, what a witness is like, adds tremendously to the opportunities to toy with their expectations. And I think most readers are ready for that. They don't want it to be all cut and dried and laid out for them. And I don't think they want just one surprise, because trials are never like that. They always have a witness who gets up and says something that you totally didn't expect them to say. I had a rape victim who had written a letter recanting her accusation. And when the hearing on recanting the accusation and dismissing the rape charge came before me, the letter was read in court. And I asked the defense attorney to hand it to the witness, and he did. And I said, now, would you please read paragraph 2 for me again? And as I suspected, this was a young woman who could not read. And if she could not read, she could not write. So there are all kinds of crazy twists and turns, and they're almost always a surprise. Occasionally, they are planned ahead of time by one side or the other. As far as your ticket is concerned, I have important legal advice for you.
Oh, yes!
Pay.
Okay, what is it? Oh, man.
Pay.
Go ahead, John. Bribe the judge. I just want to hear you.
No,
120,000
no, no.
People.
If,
watch you bribe
if
the
if
judge.
If you will
know,
have a
I
choice.
Wanna, I mean, anything to get off, because, I mean, I know I got to pay it, but I'm just hoping, because I had a little extra circumstances. I was going downhill in a big car, and I didn't want to slam on the brakes and have people behind me all messed up, so I was only going 10 miles and over the speed limit.
Oh, I know.
And I'm like, man, come on, can't you give me a break? And he even said I was only going 10 miles over.
And
yeah,
the judge
so,
is going to say to you, John, you've got three choices. You can plead guilty and pay the fine. You can plead no contest. Or you can plead not guilty, and I'll set it for trial. And then he's going to say, when you plead no contest, he's going to ask you if you know the policeman, and if you know of any reason why this policeman would want to do you dirt. And you're going to say, I never met him before in my life. And the judge is going to say, well, then I think we can assume that you were exceeding the speed limit. Guilty, pay the fine. So, you know, your time is valuable.
At least the good thing in California is I can do a written thing first and see if it works. And then I pay the money while I'll do the written and just see if I can, you know, maybe I get you know, maybe I get lucky. Everyone gets lucky. Hell, look at Lindsay Lohan. She's gotten lucky like 18 times. I mean,
yeah,
it's got to happen to somebody
else.
Lindsay
Lohan, I get lucky 20 times.
Yeah. So, I mean, so with the book and, you know, and you're, and again, we're speaking here with author Linda Roker, and it's lindaroker.com.
It's actually it's Linda Rocker.
Rocker.
It's like the rocking
chair. Why do you keep saying Roker? Okay.
No, no.
Linda Rocker.
Anyway, it's Rocker.
I said it right the first time, and then I screwed it up.
Okay.
So LindaRocker.com, and the book is Punishment. So now, you said it's a trilogy, and this is the first book in the trilogy. So what made you come right out of the gate here, and instead of kind of putting your feet in the water, you kind of jumped right into the ocean with the trilogy? What was kind of your thought process behind that? Did you just have so much information that you didn't think you could put this in a standalone and you had to make it into a three-book series?
In a way, yes, because Punishment is all about vengeance. It's really about one of the oldest themes in mythology, in the Bible. It's an eye for an eye. It's what people believe is their right to redress a wrong against them, against a loved one, sometimes just against the system itself. And we see it play out all the time, whether it's in Texas or with crazy people shooting sheriffs, or it's another vengeance murder somewhere else. But the second thing that is so key to me is the issue of blame, because what I have heard for 25 years is it really wasn't me. I didn't mean to go down that hill so fast.
I didn't.
Funny. I know. It was irresistible. But there are so many cases where charges are brought because there's this sense that somebody must be for blame and must be to blame. If you heard Conrad Murray in his interviews this week, it's a classic example. "I'm the scapegoat," you know, is his song. And poor me, and they just picked me because I was the person closest, and I'm really not to blame. And there is this sense that the system looks for someone or something to blame. Again, it's human nature. You know, I understand it. But I also understand that bad things happen, and they aren't always the fault of a single act by a single individual. So I wanted to take my characters from Punishment, keep them in the courthouse, move them outside a little bit, get them involved in some scary, exciting, and in one case, tragic incidents, and talk about this whole issue of blame. So my main character, who is new, is a doctor who prescribes too many OxyContin to a young man who overdoses, and he is charged with first-degree murder by the state on the grounds that he should have known that this young man wasn't really in legitimate pain, but was in fact looking for drugs. And the third book of the trilogy is the most interesting subject, and that is innocence. We read a great deal about the Innocence Project and people on death row discovering that they are being set free because DNA has exonerated them after 20, 30, 40 years. How is that possible in a fair system? How are there so many layers meant to protect us against putting an innocent man in jail, and all of them fail, like dominoes? They just fall over one another.
So, or giving an innocent man a speeding ticket, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We won't even, an innocent man. How
right.
did that happen?
22 years, no speeding ticket, and now I get one.
You see,
hey, you know, Linda, if John winds up going to court on this ticket, he's going to get 30 days. He's not going to get the fine. He's going to get the judge so upset.
That is the likelihood, which is why
yeah,
I was advising
yeah.
you. Take a dive.
I know. I should just throw myself at the risk and say, okay, I did it.
Absolutely. Your Honor, I'll
yeah.
never drive another hill again.
Never. I'm not driving that stupid road to go to the beach.
Hey, John, we have time for another question?
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah,
okay.
We got about another minute and a half.
All right. One of the things I liked about your book, Punishment, Linda, was you mentioned Charlotte's Web earlier. One of the great openings in any novel ever written was in Charlotte's Web, where the author writes, "Mommy, where's Daddy going with the axe?"
Right.
And you had some real zingers like that in your book, and one of them was, "There is little that stands between a competent killer and his prey." And I wanted to compliment you on that, because you raised the blood pressure of the reader with those kinds of statements. And I mean, not a lot of description there. You left it up to the reader's imagination to kind of picture that competent killer and prey on the other side. And so I just wanted to compliment you. I thought the writing was very, very tight and kind of a roller coaster ride that was a fun ride.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Quite welcome.
Well, yeah, Linda, I want to thank you again so much for coming on. Well, half thank you. I mean, even though you gave me bad information. But the book, everybody, is well what you need to pick up in legal thrillers. It's called Punishment, lindarocker.com. I got that one right.
And
we're looking forward to, you know, the next one, the next book, and then, of course, the end of the trilogy. So please stay in touch with us. Let us know when it's coming out, because we would definitely want to follow and see what's coming up next, because it's just going to be great to watch your ride as you rise up with a lot more readers and a lot more followers. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us.
Thank you. I love your show.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. And we love your writing. And, again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, guys. Be well.
Thank you, Linda.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Linda Rocker, and it's lindarocker.com. The book is Punishment, the first in her legal trilogy, not really named. And to check out a lot more information, just go to her website. We're going to be back here with our last segment. It's author Jake Patterson, and he is going to talk to us about his latest book. So in the meantime, we are going to have this last break for you.
find anyone, no one is going to understand you exactly the way I do. Well, I think I said it all.
So again, everybody, I want to welcome all the guests that we've had on the show here today, starting back with author Jamie Mason, and then Juliana Baggett, and we just had Linda Rocker on to talk all about their books. Again, I want to thank Joseph Bedell for coming on and being our special guest host. JosephBedellBooks.com, author of Shell Game, Terror Cell, Evil Deeds. Joseph, I want to thank you real fast before we get to our next guest.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
And so, without further ado, we are going to go here. His book is called Cross the Line. His name is Jack Patterson, not Jake. I screwed that one up. And it's IamJackPatterson.com is his website. So, Jack, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
So, again, so the book is Cross the Line. And when first people are going to notice it, they're going to notice the football on the cover. So they're going to know that there has some kind of sports aspect to it. So can you tell everybody a little bit about the book that might not be on the back cover?
Yeah, sure. This Cross the Line is the second book in the Cal Murphy thriller series that I've been writing. And basically, Cal is a journalist who's kind of rising in the ranks, and he's covering the Seattle Seahawks in the Super Bowl. And, I mean, I know it's fiction, but...
It happened about 7 years ago, I think. So
yeah,
was not
yeah,
too
it
much.
Did. That's right. It might happen again with Russell Wilson, but that's another conversation.
Well, why don't you write one about the Vikings going to the Super Bowl, because that is freaking fiction.
Well, I have to have something that's somewhat believable. So.
Yeah, I know. Thanks a lot with that.
All of our Minnesota listeners, John.
Oh, yeah, all four.
Well, I grew up a Braves fan, so I don't have a whole lot of love lost in my heart for Minnesota after watching them, you know, rip the Braves in the World Series, and I have long
That's
bitterness
true.
In my heart. So, but no, seriously, back to this book. The story is about Cal Murphy is the kind of the main center of the story, but he's a reporter and he's covering the Seahawks, and he finds out that the aging veteran quarterback for the Seahawks, who spent his entire career trying to get the team to the Super Bowl, is 6 days before the Super Bowl, his son is kidnapped. And the ransom is that he has to throw the game or else he's never going to see his son again. So it kind of sets the backdrop in an interesting way. He discovers this. He can't go to shouldn't go to the authorities. But Cal convinces the quarterback to do that. So they end up figuring out working with the FBI to form a joint sting to go rescue his son. And then that's when everything goes off the rails. So it's not as much football, I think, as people like to think, but there's been quite a few comments I've had about that. I think people think there's going to be a ton of football in it or might shy away from the book because of that. But it does cover the Super Bowl and what ends up happening, and it's a fun thrill ride, I think.
Well, I just had to – I know this sounds like an unserious question, but, you've obviously been – you're passionate about sports. You made a living out of sports writing, and now you write novels about the subject. How lucky are you, and you know, how do you justify getting paid to do this?
Well, it's a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun doing it when you're writing the stuff that's nonfiction reporting for – newspapers and magazines and that sort of thing. And,
sure.
It was a thrill. But, there's some things about sports. Some of your stories, there are a lot of great stories in sports. But there's a lot of times where what I discovered is, as I was covering sports, that there's all these things that aren't related to sports that go on around the game itself and things like that. And so, I felt like, this is kind of a genre or a niche, I guess, within the thriller genre that isn't really touched on a lot. People don't talk about sports writers. There's always, investigative reporters and that sort of thing. But the sports writers, you enter it into the profession thinking you're going to go watch, for example, this weekend, the Final Four. I've covered Final Four before, awesome, amazing thing. And you think that's what you're going to be doing. It's going to be fun. You watch the big games, at the parties. You tell all your friends, I was in L.A. or I was wherever, and I got to see those games that you watched on TV. It's a lot of fun. But somewhere along the way, you realize that it's not just about that. It's about, you have to dig up, reporting. Yeah, you cover recruiting, which is, like, that's like sports writer hell.
And it was even worse back in the day before, you know, you could get the information readily on the internet. I mean, you had to, you know, you had to have sources. I had one source from when I was covering recruiting that was, he was an insurance salesman, and he told me that if I ever needed anything, to call him, and if I was in any meeting and they said he's in a meeting, just say the word recruiting, and his secretary would patch me through. So he helped me break a big national story one time when I hit a brick wall with it. But there is so much around that doesn't involve the actual game itself, you know, whether it's contract disputes or, you know, there's lawsuits or, you know, Manti Te'o, for example. I mean, we all know that story. I mean, that was in the mainstream media. But things like that that we kind of, you know, you find out that you have to do that too. And so building stories around, you know, kind of around the game, you know, some of the peripheral things that happen, I thought would make for, you know, interesting theater.
Well, the one thing is I think that sport, and I do think that it's not used enough, because whenever you have, like, thriller or suspense, you always have to have some kind of corruption and something going on. And what better than sports, with the amount of money that is either bet on the games or the amount of money that is made? I mean, you see NFL players, you see NBA, you see Major League Baseball, all the billions and billions of dollars that are put into that is probably, when you put it all together, you know, larger than any other kind of entity that is in the United States. I mean, they're so passionate about it, but you don't really hear of that backroom corruption, except maybe in boxing or a recruit getting paid or something like that. And then some people are like, oh yeah, but you know, that's not really hurting anybody. You're just hurting the bettors.
Yeah.
But there are built-in storylines that are already there, and you know, and I don't think that it's used enough. So I think it's very refreshing that you were able to kind of go in and tackle the subject of, you know, when you're watching a game, now you kind of wonder, and you sit there and say, wow, the guy plays so well up to a certain point, but then all of a sudden when he hits this big game, it's like he just disappears.
Yeah,
was there something
wonder.
Going on?
Right, exactly. It's funny, one of the readers wrote me about after reading Cross the Line. He was reading it the week before the Super Bowl, and he said, I was on an airplane reading it 30,000 feet in the air and wondering, is anybody keeping these players' families safe? And I thought, you know,
really?
I mean, you know, you hate to, you know, you propose things like this, but you know, something like this could, you know, could conceivably happen. And, you know, as, you know, as corrupt as, like you mentioned, there's just so much money in sports, and that's usually where your corruption lies. I mean, what do we look at? You know, a lot of thrillers center around pharmaceutical things that have gone bad, especially your law thrillers. I mean, that's a popular one because why? You know, they make billions and billions of dollars, and so there's people stand a lot to gain or lose by that, and certainly in sports. And so, you know, the next book that I'm writing in the series also tackles that with the NFL and a lot with the concussion.
No pun intended, tackle that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry, I use these metaphors all the time. You know, it tackles that and concussions and, you know, moving teams around. I mean, it's a, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there. And, you know, and I found out, you know, as I got into it that, you know, there's a lot of people that are really passionate about, you know, owners and you know, managers, kind of leaders within the programs or franchises. They really, you know, they really do care about it. But then there's other people that you can tell that, you know, are just a little shady. They're there to make money, and it's a business venture, and, you know, it seemed to steal the fun out of what people are doing.
You know, the there's so much money involved, and we've elevated these kids to on, you know, huge heights. They become superheroes in our society, and then when they screw up, everybody just gets this wonderful, visceral enjoyment out of watching them crash.
Yeah.
And so there's so much meat here to write about. You know, as John said, money and corruption and you know, heroes crashing and becoming goats. And I mean, it's just a lot of great material in the sports world.
Yeah, and you know, the I guess, you know, I've stuck so far, you know, sticking with the, you know, the NFL scene, but I am the projected, you know, where I'm going with this is going to be going into college in the South and recruiting, and that's kind of where, you know, I used to cover Georgia and SEC schools, and also covered some ACC schools in the South, and You know, it's a different world down there. I mean, what those people, what football means to them, and
got
you know,
that
how
right.
they treat it. I mean, here you see what's going on at Auburn right now, and you
it's
know,
a religion.
It's kind of,
I mean, it's literally a religion, and people that don't watch sports don't understand that. It's their,
yeah,
it's their
mean,
religion from
yeah,
September to January.
The only people I think who could really understand it would be people who live in, you know, Europe and follow soccer.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's pretty, they're pretty passionate about it over there. But in the States, I don't know that, I mean, even the, you know, up in the Northeast where, you know, people are pretty passionate about their NFL teams, I still don't think it's like the live and die mentality, you know, people have with that team as they do in the South. I mean, they're so,
right.
you know, because you went to school there or your uncle went there or, you know, you had a great-grandfather that went there or whatever, however you tie yourself to that school. And, you know, you'll fight about it, you know, if people talk trash about your school. And so, you know, it's a, yeah, it's pretty rich in the things around it. And you can get some really good characters. You know, I met some that are real life, and I will have a lot of fun basing, you know, characters off of Don, the insurance salesman from Commerce, Georgia. So, you know, it should be
yeah.
fun.
So what's and again, and we're speaking here with author Jack Patterson, and it's IamJackPatterson.com is the book. The latest book is called Cross the Line. It's the second in the series of the Cal Murphy thriller series. And so, and I always kind of ask the question, you know, kind of your kind of debut book was Crosshairs, kind of came out now with Cross the Line. What was kind of your thinking when you decided, hey, I want to start getting into this thriller realm and I'm going to start writing about stuff that I know, which is going to be, you know, the outlining story of sports, but within the thriller realm of suspense and everything genre. Why did you decide to go ahead and start right off with the series instead of deciding, hey, you know what, let's kind of do this standalone to kind of see how it works and maybe then pick out some character or a character that you really enjoyed writing about and then taking them further or exploring them that way?
Well, you know, I guess I started out kind of thinking in that vein. I mean, I, you know, have a, you know, talked kind of around, been around publishing and writers and, you know, I had mostly worked in the nonfiction world, you know, ghostwriting and that sort of thing. I did some co-authoring, but mostly ghostwriting. And so I got, you know, it's hard to people who had kind of done both and, you know, encouraged me. They're like, you should do it. And if you do it, make sure that you do it in a series. I mean, it really, it can really attract readers and people can kind of get tied to a character. So, you know, when I started out, I kind of had this, actually, you know, it kind of evolved from a kind of a conglomeration of a couple of my friends. You know, Cal Murphy is, you know, kind of this, in the first novel, he's stuck in a weekly newspaper and these high school athletes die and he has to, you know, and nobody really seems concerned in the small community and he wonders, why isn't anybody concerned? But he, you know, he was kind of a character who was kind of lost his luster for newspaper reporting, and you know, his dream seemed dashed, like he's never going to get to write at a big newspaper. And you know, I worked at smaller newspapers, and I knew so many people like that. They came in, they wanted to do something big, and then they kind of their dream died, you know, and they're stuck in Cordial, Georgia, at a you know 3,000 weekly newspaper. I mean, you know, it's like it's
yeah.
sad. But then there's, but so I wanted to take a character that you know kind of like. You know, it seemed like he was almost done with it, ready to move on, and then he kind of got reignited in his passion for it, and I could see, you know, just the, because of so many different things, you know, the trajectory of his career, and have a lot of friends, you know, who've done that, you know, who've gone on to, you know, really, I mean, you know, high spotlight, high profile positions, you know, ESPN or Sports Illustrated and things like that, you know, doing, writing for, you know, these major newspapers, and then I have other friends that, you know, we were all in the same class together, and they petered out after, you know, 6 years, 5 years, they were done with it. So I kind of had a, you know, an idea of kind of melding those, you know, different types, that, a character like that between all these people that I knew. And it would have a lot of fun because of that. So I know it may not have been as conventional, but I was determined that I was going to do this. And, you know, at first it was a hobby, but you know, now I'm really pursuing it full time. So,
you know, the I noticed in your bio that you were born in England.
Well, I wasn't born in England, but I lived in England.
Okay.
I lived there for, yeah, I lived there for about 3 years when I was just learning to read. So, yeah, we lived on a baron and baroness's estate, and they were, my dad was in the military, and my dad said, if we're going to live in England, let's live like the English people. So at a very young age, I got, you know, into the culture, learned a lot about soccer, or football, as they called it, and you know, started, you know, learning about the English culture, learned to read like they did, which is totally different than here. Like, I don't even know what phonics are. I still can't read phonetically. But they, you know, I just loved it. So that was kind of, and we saw the world when I was a little kid. So we got to go to a bunch of different places, and really an amazing, you know, opportunity for me as a little guy growing up, but kind of gave me a little bit broader world perspective.
Well, I know I'll get ridiculed by John, who's a big football fan, but I'm a huge soccer fan. And
oh, I'm a big soccer fan. I love soccer. Bayern Munich, baby. They won it 2-0. Going to first leg. Next, yeah, they beat Gervonta in the first leg of the Champions League quarterfinals. You bet.
Oh,
I was watching soccer before the show started.
Oh, my
nice.
God.
I saw Arsenal beat West Bromwich 2-1. So I saw that. Yeah. I'm a worldly guy, Joseph. I'm an enigma wrapped up in a shell.
You are a renaissance man if I've ever seen
uh-huh.
one. Jack, if you ever want to write a book about soccer, about football, you should give me a call. We'll co-author a book. I don't know if you've ever read the book The Miracle of Castel di Sangro by Joe McGinnis, which is about a team in the hinterlands in Italy that was third division that winds up getting relegated all the way up to the first division, and it is just fascinating. And I think there's so much, because you don't have to leave Georgia to find all kinds of sports intrigue, but I've always thought, geez, it would be great to write a book about British or soccer or Italian soccer. So.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I've actually have a few in my, you know, my idea file for that. You know, some things based around the World Cup and you know, seeing some of the international stuff that happens internationally. I mean, there's the corruption goes on there all the time, especially in Italy, like you mentioned, you know, Italian soccer. Yeah. They've had their share of scandals, but yeah, I mean, you know, it's. Depends on. I mean, actually, my books sell pretty well over in the UK, so I know that audience over there might, you know, at some point would definitely be a titillating subject for them to talk about an English Premier League team or something like that. But you know, I grew up rooting for Ipswich, and they're in the Championship flight, not the Premier Division, and I'm a long suffering fan of them, and I don't know that they'll ever get back. So
it's hard.
It's been difficult.
And the one thing that we talked about, and I'm just going to kind of get off the sports theme, because when we talked off the air, there was something very intriguing that is you have coming out in October that you just got done researching, and I thought that it was something that we got to bring up on the air. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about what you just did and what's coming out in October that has nothing related to sports?
Yes, if you're into more of the political conspiracy-minded thrillers, like this new series, it'll be a new series that I'm starting coming out in October, but it's a book called The War on Omissions, and it's going to be based off of a lot of the research that I did on the JFK assassination at the National Archives. So I just spent the last week in Washington poring over the papers, which, you know, anybody can do this, but I was absolutely fascinated by the inner workings of our government and how they, you know, track down killers and, you know, how they gather information and intel on certain people, and there's so much there. I have a friend of mine that works there, and he called me up and said, you need to come research some of this stuff for, you know, good fodder for a novel. So I went up there and kind of had in mind what I want to do. I mean, if you just go there and you have no idea, it's so overwhelming, because you're talking about, you walk into a building with 1.8 million square feet of documents, and you've got to figure out what you want, and it's just a really interesting process of how you get your hands on the information. But I started researching JFK, and, you know, the final analysis from the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 70s was that JFK was likely killed by some kind of international conspiracy, or some kind of conspiracy happened, but we just don't know who or what or how. That was kind of the conclusion, which to me is pretty weak. So I started looking around, and I'm not one to, like, you know, think everything's a conspiracy, but I thought it would be fun to, you know, take on in a new series a character who kind of investigates conspiracies and government conspiracies, you know, and he's always about to uncover something, and, you know, somebody comes after him that wants to keep the truth suppressed. So within the JFK assassination papers, there were some really interesting characters, one of which was, I don't I've never heard about this, read about, you know, the JFK assassination, read a lot of books on it, watched movies. You don't really hear much about a character named George de Morenschild. And I started reading about this guy, and he was fascinating. He was born in Russia. His parents were arrested by the Bolsheviks. They were sent to Siberia. They escaped. He went to Poland, then to Germany, and then came to the U.S. via Belgium. And then basically preyed off of, widows, wealthy widows, ended up with four wives in the U.S. and became like this attaché to all these governments in, Yugoslavia, Germany. The FBI was investigating him for a while. For 6 years, they thought he was a Nazi agent. Then they thought he was a KGB agent. And then he knew everybody. He met the day that Lee Harvey Oswald moved into town. He drove 30 miles across Dallas to meet him. And he met him also in Cuba. He did a lot of business in Mexico City. I mean, there's so many things about this guy. And I was like, this is a guy that, everything could hang on, and it's this possibility that you could build an entire conspiracy around him. So that was, so as I began to do this research, I found this really, really interesting character. And then, strange anomalies within, within what the government did and how they handled things. So really fascinating, and I'm really excited about, delving into this novel. And, I've already started writing it, just to have something come out, around the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination, will be a lot of fun to talk about it and talk about some of the things that I found in my research.
Didn't de Morenschild, wasn't he friendly is the right word, but wasn't he acquainted with the Bushes?
He was, yes. I actually saw there's a handwritten note that he sent him basically asking when George Bush was leading the CIA, he asked him to kind of help the CIA back off. He felt like he was being bugged. And there's an interesting letter where he said, hey, I don't know what's going on, but I don't know why people are all of a sudden tracking me or watching me, but this has got to stop. And George Bush wrote him back, said, sorry about all that. There's nothing I can really do to help you. So in other words, yes, we're following you, and too bad. He was acquainted with the Bushes. He was also acquainted with the Onassises. He knew Jackie when she was a little girl. There's some interesting storylines there. He also was connected with Richard Helms. And when George de Morenschild, he was supposed to speak to an independent investigator with the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And he suddenly shot himself. There was no suicide note or anything. And the thing about with Richard Helms was Richard Helms, he eventually took over the CIA. But before that, during this time when supposedly the CIA was, working with de Morenschild to gather information, from his overseas visits, Richard Helms was running this project called Project Artichoke, which, is really laughable, I think. What a hilarious name. They have much better names. Like in Fringe, they have better names than this. But Project Artichoke, it was a mind control program where they could give you certain chemicals to make you do certain things. So, the whole suicide or alleged suicide around his death was really strange. And his body was cremated within 6 days. I mean, it was, I read the reports and everything, and he was done, taken care of. So there's a lot of, things that if you want to, you can find him there and you can see him. And I was just absolutely fascinated by it, and can't wait to fictionalize a lot of this stuff and, people who have theories about, about who killed JFK and how it all went down. This should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, you may accuse me of being paranoid, but that doesn't mean that there isn't somebody hiding behind every bush.
Oh no! some of the more interesting reading I found was in the Nazi war crime papers, where you could read about CIA operations and how they spied on the Soviet embassy in different countries. I mean, I read this one project called Katomic operation, and it was how they recruited spies and how they got information. They planted bugs on Soviet embassy workers who they believed were part of KGB intelligence, and that stuff is just, I mean, it's fascinating. It's more interesting than things I've seen in the movies. So it's, as far as sitting there reading, it's just, it's not a book. It's an archive. So it's just, basically reports. But you're pouring through this going, wow, they used this housekeeper, a single mother that was a housekeeper to make, to jam the lock so that they could send a certain locksmith to unjam the Soviet embassy worker's key and then to make a copy for the U.S. operatives who were going to go in his house and spy on him. I mean, they're just crazy stuff that they did and got away with it. You know, it's just, it was so interesting.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jack. I mean, just when you just sit there and you're talking about how much research and stuff that you just did on a book that's coming out in October leads credence to know that people should definitely go out and read Cross the Line, go get Crosshairs, because you can just tell that the passion and the effort that you're putting into your book is second to none. And that's the reason why, you know, we love to support authors like yourself that do the extra leg work to bring the entertainment value up to that higher level to the fans. And we want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about it.
Well, thanks, John and Joseph. I really appreciate you guys having me on and chatting about this.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, and we want to bring you back on again. So when your book comes out, whenever, please stay in contact with us, you know, to have you back on, like I said, again, to talk about everything that you got going on, because I just find it all terribly fascinating. And we could probably go for another 2 hours just on all the extra subject, but, you know, I'll tell
you.
We've
got to watch the final four today. That's what we can't talk all day.
But, you know, I got my priorities because I'm actually going to the Dodger game today and I'm going to miss Michigan, but I'm going to check it on my phone because I figured, you know what, if they lose, I didn't really have to watch it. And if they win, then I'm going to watch the more important game on Monday anyway. So that's what I'm going to do.
I'm glad there's somebody else that thinks like that. I'm as much as a sports fan as I am, when it's my team, you know, I'm still the same way. I'm like, I don't want to see it if they lose, which – you know, yeah. I had my teams are college team is Georgia and my pro team is the Atlanta Falcons. So I had a rough year this year.
You did, and I get my condolences. And I've been a Viking fan since 1975, so we're in the same boat. And I still hate the Falcons because of 1998. So basically, you know, you guys can go screw yourself.
We're even.
So
I hate to win.
Note, everybody, we want again, Jack. We want to thank you so much for coming on, and you have a great day. And we'll talk with you later.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Bye, Jack. All right, bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Jack Patterson with his book called Cross the Line. And it is IamJackPatterson.com is the website. Well, Joseph, we've had a fabulous show. We want to thank you so much for coming on and being a guest host with me. And you're welcome anytime, and we can banter this back and forth again. It was a fabulous show.
Well, thank you, John. And thank you for what you do for the suspense genre. You guys are great.
Well, thank you again. And again, everybody, that is suspensemagazine.com. The April issue will be out shortly. For anything that you have, just email editor@suspensemagazine.com. We'll be happy to send you 4 free issues wherever you got to go. You got an interesting guest, you got a book or whatever, we'd love to hear it. Until next time. Check out suspensemagazine.com. Click on Suspense Radio to see what is coming up in future shows. And we will see you all later. Sorry about that. Go Wolverine. Go Dodgers. Have a good one.